with us at the invitation of a program sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court. The program's called Court with Class. We invite students from around the state to join us for an oral argument, and if the invitation is accepted, briefs of the case they are to hear are sent to the students, and they may do some extra work on the case. And then students come, and they will meet with a justice of this court at noon, at which time there will be discussion of the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved in the case. Anyone who wishes to join the students at noon, you're all welcome, including counsel. So let me ask the Deerfield High School students to stand, please. Welcome. You may be seated. And let me ask the Palmyra High School students to stand. We're delighted to have you also. You may be seated. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left, Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. You will meet with Justice Bradley after the second case at approximately noon. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. If anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, the marshal has such a summary. If you raise your hand, she will bring it to you. I'll call our first case, 048P468, Burbank Grease Services versus Larry Sokolowski et al. The lineup of attorneys is 25 minutes David Sissons, 15 minutes Stephen Eisenberg, 15 minutes Mark Furman, and Mr. Sissons, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Is that agreeable? Okay. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning. That is louder than I thought.
You woke us up.
I forgot my coat again today for the second time in 2 days, so it might take me a while to warm up, literally and figuratively. I thought of that sitting there, but it is true. May it please the court, my name is David Sisson. I represent Burbank Grease Services. And I have the honor of coming before you today on what I believe is a case that will have a profound impact on the way that relationships between employers and employees are viewed in Wisconsin. Until now, it has always been the standard that it's wrong for a trusted agent in a position of trust to do harm intentionally to that agent's principal. But in deciding that the trade secret statute preempts any other claim involving confidential information that doesn't rise to the level of a trade secret, the decision of the Court of Appeals really changes that rule in a fundamental way and with consequences that I don't know were fully appreciated before, and hopefully I can explain to you today. And I'm hoping if you take one thing away after I've had a chance to make a presentation to you, it's that all of these very negative connotations that come from the interpretation of the statute applied by the Court of Appeals don't need to be. There's a very easy way to read the statute at issue. It can and should, and I think we should assume, was always meant by the legislature to be interpreted in a way that doesn't create an incentive for someone to steal somebody else's valuable assets. Larry Sokolowski was a manager for Burbank Grease, and the facts are fairly simple and straightforward. After Mr. Sokolowski left Burbank Grease, he eventually formed a competing business, and he had, when he still worked at Burbank Grease, accumulated some confidential information during the course of his employment.
Counsel, let me, if I might, interrupt you at this point.
Yes.
I was zeroing in and sitting here thinking about what you said about preemption and how you seem to feel that preemption, as applied by the Court of Appeals and the trial court, is a terrible step in terms of Wisconsin law. Tell us why.
You just asked the most important question, of course, anybody can ask here today. I think this really zeroes in on it. Preemption has a purpose in many circumstances. Sometimes it's broad preemption, sometimes it's much more narrow. For example, a federal law that preempts a state law, I think the example was given in the briefs before, laws involving aviation. There certainly is a need to have uniformity, and it's something that, if it's a federal law, can really be applied and mandated to every other state. But in this kind of a situation, if we're going to try to follow what other courts have done, and I know I'm touching a little bit on the issue of uniformity as opposed to preemption, but there is a purpose in analyzing the statute in the narrow way that I believe it was created in the first place. The reason I think that preemption is a problem is because the plain language of the statute, which is really where we ought to begin, indicates that the only claims that are intended to be covered under the statute are those involving trade secrets. If you then take away the entire universe of other available tort claims involving confidential information that doesn't rise to the level of a trade secret, you'll essentially prevent someone from having any sort of remedy if they've suffered a significant injury.
But isn't there a simple answer to that in terms of having the employee sign a confidentiality agreement? And therefore, if it's breached, you've got a breach of contract claim?
That is certainly one remedy. I would say that a contract, a confidentiality agreement between an employer and employee, then allows for certain remedies and has a certain standard of proof. There's certain elements involved in it, which are different from tort claims. It very well may be easier to enforce an agreement as long as you have offer, acceptance, and consideration than it is to establish that there's a fiduciary duty or other elements that are parts of these other claims.
As long as the agreement is reasonable.
Absolutely. But this court, over the last several years, when dealing with restrictive covenants, confidentiality agreements, and non-compete agreements, has refined, shall I say, in many instances, what those rules are in a way that makes an agreement that was arguably enforceable in 1999 not enforceable today. And as I'll say a little bit more, I think this type of an application, which allows the only remedy as a contract remedy, does the most harm to small businesses, those companies that don't have access to legal resources and, frankly, don't change their contracts every year. That is the reality of most situations where something like this occurs.
Well, counsel, you talk about preemption of civil remedies. What civil remedies would be preempted here that have been already adopted in Wisconsin?
There's a pretty broad range. I mean, the most obvious example, I believe, are claims for breach of fiduciary duty, duty of loyalty, and even something like conversion. If you read the Court of Appeals decision, as I believe it's written, the trade secret statute preempts any other civil remedy involving confidential business information. Any other restitutionary remedy, any tort remedy, any remedy of any other law of the state of Wisconsin. So the consequence of this is you can steal your employer's information intentionally. You can plan to do it before you leave and get away with it. In this situation, it's undisputed that the employee in question gathered the information legitimately in the course of his job. But the effect of this rule is to allow an employee to plan to leave and to gather information that could be valuable to use and really harmful to take away from the employer, and yet that employer would have no remedy. And the oddity is that employee may have a fiduciary duty in every other instance to protect the assets of the employer, to make sure that the shop is locked up at night. But the one area that would be carved out is anything involving the operations of their business, their confidential information.
I was going to say, even if you, and I think Justice Crooks touched on this, even if you assume under preemption that we should not allow that here, and I'm just looking at the facts of this case, but obviously it's going to apply to many others, the rights and remedies were there for Burbank, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that they had a code of conduct. Bukowski signed the code of conduct. But when he left in 2001, there was no exit interview. There was no request for material that was allegedly inadvertently in his home. There was no signing of any document as far as a non-compete, as Justice Crooks referred to. So the remedy to some of the concerns you have is there, but just my question is, it appears, and you can debate this, that Burbank did not avail themselves of any of these concerns. In other words, not only with this employee, but other employees, I understand, and if I read this wrong, they didn't have a pattern of doing anything. You're saying, well, that's because this court may have limited the non-compete clause, but I think here it's clear that with a little bit of foresight, there could have been some protection for Burbank. Do you disagree with that?
I do believe that the facts of this case are compelling for a different result. I do agree that the application will go way beyond this case, but even in this case alone, I think it's speculation to guess at what would have happened in an exit interview, but I can say that Mr. Sokolowski is a manager. There's no dispute, knew that the information at issue was confidential. He signed a code of conduct saying it was confidential. Whether he would or wouldn't have given it back in an exit interview, I don't think is something we can speculate on. But what we do know is this. When he found the information, he thought it valuable enough that he inputted the data into his new competitive business's database and used it to compete. This is golden rule type of analysis, but when you find something that doesn't belong to you, what's the first reaction? You give it back. Most of us, in that instance, if we found something that belonged to our former employer, would give it back. And in fact, in this case, after Mr. Sokolowski had already used the information competitively for several months, he was confronted about it by Burbank Greece's counsel, and the information was destroyed. But after this ruling, you would not need to destroy the information. In fact, you wouldn't need to give it back. And those are a couple of the consequences that I wanted to talk to you about.
Well, before you get to the consequences, a lot of that argument seems to be premised, if I'm hearing you correctly, in the argument you make in your briefs, starting, I think, on page 23, from the restatement second of agency, section 396. Now, both opposing counsel in their briefs have asserted that we find no Wisconsin court setting 396 of the 58 restatement in support of a breach of loyalty claim. I believe that's in the United's brief, and in Mr. Sokowski's brief. Burbank has not, however, cited any Wisconsin cases recognizing this to be the law in Wisconsin. Now, both of those statements are a little different than saying there are no cases in Wisconsin that deal with the restatement and adopting the restatement 396. So I want to ask you, in making this argument, this kind of goes to my question about preemption and whether or not there are any remedies that are preempted here. Has Wisconsin adopted restatement second agency 396?
No Wisconsin court has directly addressed the issue. That is about all I can say about it. But it is very well-established law, the fundamental principle that you have a duty to your employer that may continue after you leave if you have their property is something that's been fairly well recognized. Some of the consequences I was suggesting before, an employee who intended to leave and compete could literally back the U-Haul up in the middle of the night, take out boxes and boxes of information. And that's because a lot of information that a company uses every day to run its business don't rise to the level of a trade secret. A trade secret is a very important thing. We all think of it as like the formula for Coca-Cola. But that is one narrow subset of all the valuable confidential information that a business uses. There's financial information, there's personnel information, there's information related to how customers are specifically serviced.
Sissons, the Court of Appeals, as I understand it, held that these customer lists and information were not trade secrets. You did not seek review of that.
This is correct.
So, as I understand the posture of this case, we're fighting about information that Mr. Sokolovsky gave that are not trade secrets. And that should you prevail, and this case goes back to the circuit court, you would have to show that although not protected trade secrets, the information is of such a nature, confidential or whatever, that it is protected and that there is a remedy for these acts. Is that the posture?
That's exactly correct.
Okay.
There are many categories of very valuable confidential information that would be useful to a competitor or harmful to no longer have that don't rise to the level of a trade secret. And, you know, giving some examples, certain classes of financial information that a company may have, personnel information, again, details of how a customer is serviced. For example, I may have a piece of information that gives all of the route information on when to drop off a product or pick up a product. And if I don't have that in my business and I lose that customer as a result, I've lost something very valuable. But that information may not rise to the level of a trade secret. There are a number of elements that have to be met in order to get the extraordinary relief that's offered under the trade secret statute. And nobody denies that that's a special category of protection that should be allowed. But there are other things that are just as valuable. And this ruling does not simply apply to a situation where an employee finds things that he had taken legitimately before. This would allow theft. This would allow conversion with no repercussions whatsoever.
Counsel, this is, a difficult case in many ways, and it requires some line drawing. And it seems to me that the lines in this kind of a case should, as much as possible, not be blurred. In other words, you suggest that personnel information may be confidential, or some financial information may be confidential. And yet, people are leaving their jobs day in and day out, and probably in some degree, carrying with them, either physically or in their minds, this kind of information. And I'm concerned about the proliferation of litigation and the uncertainty in something that needs certainty with your argument.
I can't agree more. I think a bright line can and should be drawn, and it was drawn by the legislature when they created the statute. What's said on this preemption issue.
So give us your plain meaning construction of this statute, which you just segued into.
The plain meaning is that it applies to trade secrets and trade secrets alone.
And you're referring to specifically sub 6?
Sub 6, which says, using a double negative, other than that, it's pretty clear that this does not apply to any civil remedy not based upon a misappropriation of a trade secret. So it says this section does not affect a civil remedy not based upon misappropriation of a trade secret.
And
that is a simple standard.
That's 6B2 that you're referring to.
6B2. And the only way to read it the way that the Court of Appeals has is to add extra language at the end, which says, not based upon misappropriation of a trade secret or other confidential business information, which then takes the narrow universe of trade secrets and expands it to anything that may be in any way confidential. I don't think the Court can and should try to draw those types of lines, which are often factual issues, that are best left up to a jury as to whether a certain standard can be met, for example, for the trade secret elements, or whether something is valuable as confidential information. But the easy way to harmonize everything here is to just imagine that the legislature meant what it said, that this is a remedy for trade secret. And it's logical to have it preempt other overlapping claims. For example, if I did take the formula for Coca-Cola and I brought a duty of loyalty claim and a conversion claim and all these other claims, but it's established that that is a trade secret, then I shouldn't have all these other duplicative remedies that have different elements and different standards and different levels of relief. So that's a proper place to displace it. But to take away any other claim where literally you can steal information or destroy information with impunity is wrong.
Well, counsel, should we agree with you, where do we find your remedies?
The remedies are in many other places. I can give you a couple of examples.
Tell me where we find your remedies. If you're asking for this to go back, what are we going to send it back for?
There is a claim for breach of fiduciary duty, duty of loyalty, and this particular employee in question was at a management level and would have had that fiduciary duty. In other instances...
That's under what source? What restatement? Are you
getting
312?
Yes.
All right.
Breach of fiduciary duty, duty of loyalty. In other instances, I know you asked about this case, but in other instances there may be conversion claims. Let me give you one example that's very clear here. I won't spend any more time talking about the Computer Crimes Act issue. We briefed it already, but I think it's a good example to use. The trade secret statute says, again, that when it discusses the effect on other laws, that it displaces conflicting tort law, restitutionary law, and any other law of this state providing a civil remedy. Well, if you look at that computer crime statute, which is designed to protect computer data, there is an injunctive provision there. So if somebody takes your confidential information off the computer and uses it, you can at least get it back or stop it from being used in the future. And that provision is used widely. But if this is interpreted as broadly as the Court of Appeals has suggested, that if that information that they pull off the computer happens to be confidential business information but not a trade secret, then according to that reading, you don't have a remedy as injunctive relief under that computer crime statute. And it doesn't make sense. It seems to conflict. It doesn't make logical sense unless you just read the statute as it's written.
Other than 396 and 312, are there any other remedies that you suggest we should be looking at?
There may be other remedies based on the circumstances. For example, there may be a conspiracy claim. Two parties have conspired to take confidential information. But if the suggestion is they conspired and they took it, but it's not a trade secret, then there are no consequences, then that may be another source of relief. In this case, though, a duty of loyalty claim was clearly pled, and Burbank Grease has a right to have a jury make a determination on whether Mr. Sokolowski had that duty and whether what he did violated that duty. I don't want to leave without explaining a couple of more examples of how this can be used. Again, it can be a treacherous employee who's planning on competing and intentionally copies non-trade secret information before he or she leaves. But it can also be a disgruntled ex-employee who can destroy confidential information. Or an employee could leave and take the only copy of a valuable piece of information. It may not be a trade secret because there's many different guideposts and standards that need to be met in order to get over that hurdle of a trade secret, to get that extraordinary protection. But if somebody can take your only copy of an important document and you need it, it doesn't seem right that there's not a remedy. This is really a case of right and wrong, and a wrong should be able to be righted. There should be a remedy when somebody takes something that's yours. It's not right for me to go on your desk and take your confidential information without any consequence. But according to this ruling, a competitor, if they happen to be in the office for legitimate purposes, could do just that. That's not right.
Could I ask you, if you don't prevail here, would that impede the court's ability to adopt the restatement of agency 396?
Yes, I believe it would. I mean, I believe it would create a fairly significant roadblock because, again, the only focus hereafter on any confidential business information, at least as that part of the ruling applies, pertains to trade secrets. We've effectively made a rule that the only thing that's valuable is a trade secret. So I believe it would have an impact. It would prevent somebody from taking property or using property that doesn't belong to them and should be given back. Again, in this case, the information was destroyed once it was brought to the attention of Mr. Sokolowski and United. That will not happen in the future if this decision stands.
I'm frankly dying to know why the issue of whether these lists were a trade secret. I mean, I think it's a little bit different whether there's a misappropriation, but would this decision of the Court of Appeals have been decided, you think, in every jurisdiction around the country?
As far as the trade secrets determination, I disagree with the Court of Appeals ruling on the trade secrets issue. I believe that the things that were taken and used were, in fact, trade secrets. It contained a lot of detail regarding route information, customer-specific needs. That issue was not brought to the Supreme Court. I do believe it was wrongly decided in different jurisdictions. I do believe that there would have been a trade secret claim, but it doesn't mean the information isn't valuable and that Burbank Grease doesn't have a right to present to a jury the issue. And let somebody decide whether something wrong was done here.
Counselor, why didn't you appeal that issue to us? Why did you take it off the table?
I don't know the answer to that question. Unfortunately, since I was not involved in the briefing, I'm only involved in the oral argument, so I'm going to take the easy way out. I honestly don't know the answer to that question. Okay. I do believe it would have been a proper issue.
At this point, do we simply have to accept a published opinion that this customer information is not a trade secret in Wisconsin?
I do believe that if the Court's decision is to reverse the Court of Appeals and to allow Burbank Grease to present a claim to the jury for duty of loyalty, there's a remedy there. At least there's a remedy. What an affirmation would do would be prevent that issue from ever getting before court, ever giving Burbank Grease the chance to have some sort of a reasonable interpretation of the facts of exactly what happened. We shouldn't need to have a contract not to steal from each other. I do want to leave you with that thought. And so if there's any suggestion that you absolutely have to have a confidentiality agreement that happens to be enforceable under 2005 law, it's a really a different question. We should not have to require anyone, any one of us, to agree not to steal from each other. And just because something isn't a trade secret doesn't mean it isn't valuable, but I would submit that that's for a jury to decide. And up until now, those cases, thousands and thousands of them, every year across the state of Wisconsin, have been presented. These cases have always been pled this way up until now. This would represent a sea change, I believe, in the way that, again, relationships between employers and employees are viewed. There have always been these other tort remedies. And that's why the Court should render a decision that doesn't do harm to those other remedies and really harmonizes this law with existing law.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you,
Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Stephen Eisenberg, and I represent Larry Sokolowski on two claims, the preemption issue and the computer crime issue. Mr. Furman, who represents the United Grease and Liquid Waste, is not involved in the computer crime issue. I think the intent of the Uniform Trade Secret Act was meant to replace tort claims for unauthorized use of confidential information in the absence of a contract with a single statutory remedy.
Where does it say that?
It says that in the legislative history, and I think it also says that in the briefs that we've cited, but I think it's primarily the legislative history and in the statute, which says, except as provided, 13490 sub 6, except as provided in paragraph B, this section displaces conflicting tort law, restitutionary law, and any other law of the state providing a civil remedy for misappropriation of a trade secret.
That limits it to trade secrets, though. That doesn't involve all confidential information.
I think the case law in Wisconsin extends beyond trade secrets. I think the case law in Wisconsin is that it also protects confidential business information prior to the enactment of the UTSA in, I think, 1985. The law in this state was that Wisconsin did not prevent the use of confidential information after an agency relationship was terminated, provided there was no contract or nondisclosure agreement.
But that would be a separate issue. Wouldn't that go to the opposing counsel's argument about other civil remedies? That's why I kept asking him, what remedies are we talking about? Well, but that's different than saying the statute covers that.
Well, the statute says it does not accept for any civil remedy not based upon misappropriation of a trade secret. There is no other civil remedy in this state for the authorized disclosure of information that you legally obtained while you were working for someone.
That argument I follow, but to say that the statute then encompasses everything else is separate because the court can always create another remedy should the court choose to go that route. The statute is just limited to trade secrets, as I see.
Well, except that the prior case law here is that other confidential business information is not actionable. And the court can create a remedy, but that should be left to the legislature, not the judiciary. And if they want to do that, they can. And I think since 1985, when the legislature enacted this law, they've had the opportunity to do that, and they have not. And I think it goes back to the freedom of trade, the freedom of people to pursue any job they want. I mean, Mr. Justice Wilcox, I think, said that a business can protect itself. It can do that. But it has to take an affirmative action to do it. It has to have you sign a non-compete. It has to have you sign a non-disclosure.
What about the code of conduct?
Can we look with disfavor on non-competes as a restraint of a person's choice of where to work?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Don't we look at non-competes as a restraint on a person's right to choose to work wherever they wish?
Yes, you do. The court does.
We construe them very narrowly, don't we?
Except I think a non-compete is different from you can't work somewhere else than it is from a non-disclosure. You can't take our stuff and take it over to somewhere else and tell them how we do business. I think they are two different things, and I think disclosure of how a business operates can be protected more fully than you can't go to work for Burger King because you worked at McDonald's.
Counsel, you talked about the affirmative actions that a company would have to take. What about the code of conduct that the NMX required Burbank managers to acknowledge that's cited on page 9, I believe, of your brief, that no NMX employee shall disclose any confidential or privileged information to any person within the company who does not have a need to know or to any outside individual or organization except as required in the normal course of business? Doesn't that cover just what you said they needed to do?
Well, no. I think what it covers they need to do is have them sign something and follow the procedures, do the exit interview, do all the things they were supposed to do before they left. If you're going to follow this to the letter, you're going to have some guy taken away in his briefcase that's been working for IBM for 20 years. He's going to walk down the street, and lo and behold, he's going to find some things and all of a sudden have to make a beeline back to his old employer and give it back. Now, when he took this stuff, he had authorization to take it. He worked at home. That was perfectly okay. So after he has this document that they give out and say, everybody, you know, sign this thing, but we're supposed to follow procedures before you leave, they didn't. And when they did call him and say, we want it back, Burbank sent a letter saying, destroy it. He destroyed it. So to put the burden on Mr. Sokolowski to make sure that he takes care of all these things, after 5 years and you have God knows what in your house, I think that's unfair. And I don't think there's a remedy for that. And I don't think there's a remedy here if we took this stuff and it was confidential business information, not rising to a trade secret, that it's now somehow we've been calling it theft here, I've heard. This isn't theft. And if a competitor walks into my office and takes stuff out of my drawer, that's theft. But if my employee takes it out of my drawer and takes it home and reads it, and then it stays there, and then they use it later when I didn't say give it back, that's not theft. So I don't think it's there's an issue of taking confidential information is now become a civil remedy. You know, there are other laws. Workers' comp gives us a sole remedy. And I think the USTA UTSA as interpreted, I think as interpreted, says this is it. This is what you got. fiduciary, breach of fiduciary claims are okay.
Mr. Eisenberg, you have to stand in front.
Oh, sorry, Your Honor. That's me. I always move. Breach of fiduciary duty claims are allowed. If I'm working for Burbank and I started my own business, and while I'm starting my own business, I'm taking their stuff. Okay, that's a claim. That's a breach of fiduciary duty while I'm working there. If while I'm working there, or when I leave there, I call up former employees of Burbank and say, come work with me, come work with me. Burbank's a lousy company. I'll make better, you'll do much better with me. That, I think, is a breach of fiduciary duty. But just to take confidential information that was okay to take. And beyond that, in this case, the information was not helpful. It was.
Mr. Eisenberg, I want to just interrupt you for a minute. I have several questions, and I'm going to put it out in this form. 13491C defines trade secrets. Is it your, with one and two, is it your position that trade secrets as used in that statute may be broader than what my vernacular sense of trade secret is? Or to put it another way, is it the intent of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act to cover all confidential information worth protecting by the law under the definition of trade secrets?
I think it's meant to cover this situation where someone takes something out of, yes, I do. I mean to cover everything under the law and confidential information that's not a trade secret.
Okay. And what you mean by confidential information, not a trade secret, is trade secret as might be otherwise used than under the statute.
Yes.
Because here's the problem. If trade secret does not cover all confidential information, then you ought to have a remedy for confidential information that's not, quote, a trade secret under the statute, if the circumstances are right.
You would have a remedy if you had a nondisclosure agreement or a contract.
Okay. But then, in that nondisclosure agreement or contract, you would define what is nondisclosable.
Yes, I think you could do that.
Right. Okay. Because otherwise, if this is not a trade secret under 13490, this statute does not cover it at all. So do you get out of the statute by just saying it ain't no trade secret? So if it's, that's why I say to you, if this trade secret is all-inclusive of all confidential information, then as soon as you say it's not confidential, if that's the holding of the court, that's it.
If it's not, though, why would anybody proceed under the trade secret burden?
Well, that's the next question I have.
And then it makes the law...
Is there a burden?
I think there's a burden to show that if you're going to take something from a business, that it is actionable if it's a trade secret. And if it's not a trade secret, if we're going to just say, hey, I'm not going to call it a trade secret because I got to prove these things under 13490 sub 1 sub C.
It's going to be my point. My point is...
Well, why have the law?
Well, that's the point I'm trying to make, is that if it's... trade secret is narrowly defined, then nobody wants a trade secret because then you can go under the common law and you don't have to deal with 2A through whatever it is, D.
And doesn't that take the fire out of the statutes? It's a meaningless, worthless statute. Why even go under that? Why don't you just say he took confidential information? This statute's worthless.
Well, that's... My question really is whether or not 2A, B, and then or the subsections under A, B, really are nothing more than a restatement of the common law, so that it doesn't make any difference. So I'll go back to my real point is, what was the purpose of this Uniform Act? Is it to include all confidential information?
Yes. I think the purpose was to make a single remedy for the taking of any information, whether it's a trade secret or not, if it's confidential, in the absence of a contract or other agreement.
My next question is this. Your briefs and the Court of Appeals decision deal with cases that existed prior to 134.90, if I
yes,
my recollection's right. Okay. What value are they now? I mean, you say, and so does Mr. Sisson say, well, clearly if there was a contract here, we could sue under the contract. What good are those cases?
What good are they is that they allow this court to interpret the UTSA and allows this court to say, prior to the UTSA, the law in Wisconsin that taking confidential information after an agency relationship was terminated was not actionable, that the law in Wisconsin, that there was a policy in favor of employee mobility, and that restraint of trade should be used only absolutely necessary, that the law in Wisconsin is that unless you impose a restrictive covenant of non-competition or confidentiality that passes muster, that the parties need to bargain for those things, that there is no remedy because I took a customer list from a company I worked for that allowed me to take it home and do anything I wanted with it while I worked for them and didn't ask for it back, Your Honor.
But there were cases that said if you took a customer list and it had special information, like pricing, something else, that is protected confidential information, call it what you will, and you're going to be liable if you took it. Now, is that still good law under the UTSA?
If there's a contract, if there was just... No, I don't think it's good anymore. No. I think it shows there never was that remedy. There was not a remedy for confidential information that wasn't protected by a contract.
So you think you have to have a contract for everything in Wisconsin?
No, I don't, Your Honor. I don't.
Counsel, how about your computer?
Yeah, thank you. One issue there, Your Honor, I think we're really talking about Section 6 and Section 6 of 943.70 says it's illegal to disclose restricted access codes or other restricted access information to unauthorized persons. I think this is a hacking crime statute. I can't break into, get your passwords, steal your passwords, break into your court or the IRS's database or anybody else and start grabbing stuff from it. This law does not prohibit someone from disclosing without authorization data that was previously authorized to be disclosed. It's the computer crime is I'm stealing your password and I'm hacking in. It's war games. It's, you know, the movie with Matthew Broderick. That's what it's meant to prevent. And I don't think there's anything close to that. Section 4 prohibits taking possession of data without authorization. That's me stealing stuff from your computer. 6 says I can't even get into your computer. But it doesn't say once you got it, it's now a crime. This isn't a theft.
Isn't that argument... both sides use the word absurd, but I found that if you have something from your employer that is of a confidential nature, and you had the 17 other people had the access codes, but as long as you have the original authority to possess it, you're off the hook.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what else you can do, Your Honor, unless you have some agreement saying when you leave here, don't use it.
Well, that's why I asked the original question on the agreements. But doesn't that put the whole burden? We know that there was a signed document here, probably wouldn't be here, but there
yes,
wasn't. There wasn't. So that's the problem. And you're saying that as long as that wasn't done, then your client, so to speak, is off the hook.
I don't know what you're going to do. I mean, as I said, there's millions and millions of people who work who take stuff home from the workplace every day. And so all of a sudden, when something's taken home legally and they end the termination and they somehow use it either consciously or subconsciously.
They used it consciously.
Yeah, I understand. And it was worthless information. It was a Wendy's restaurant. I mean, how hard is it to go find the Wendy's in this state or the Hardee's?
Well,
the
perhaps it shortcut some of the process of having to call all these people. They had the number, they had how much grease they had, whatever.
I'm not so sure. I think all those things were easily obtainable anyplace else in the Wisconsin Restaurant Directory Association. But beyond that, if you're going to say you can't do this, you're going to have, and one of the justices said that you're going to be flooded with people exercising their might, like a Burbank with 12,000 customers against a United Grease with 200, saying we'll show them, and we're going to have court actions up the proverbial
River.
Thank you. That's a better word than I was going to say. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Eisenberg, could I ask you, the Wisconsin statute is somewhat different from the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. Is it less difficult or more difficult to establish a trade secret under Wisconsin law?
I think it's a good question. I don't have a good answer, but my guess would be, Your Honor, that it was meant to be, since it's going to be adopted, or a lot of states have adopted this nationally, I think they wanted, I would assume they've wanted it to make it the same. And I don't have a real good answer for you on that. But it doesn't make sense that that Wisconsin would want to make it harder or less or easier if they enacted this law with the understanding it's going to be uniform or tried to be uniform among the states.
Well, but clearly it is not uniform. The Uniform Laws Commission notes that it is not uniform. But what I haven't quite grasped is whether trade secret is any different in Wisconsin from another state, or whether it's more difficult to establish, or it's simply creating a new section, subsection within the law to establish it. I don't quite understand how our law is different and what impact that has on substance here.
I don't have a good answer for you, and I don't know that. And all I can do is tell you I could brief that issue. I haven't compared it to other states' laws, Your Honors. I'm sorry.
A 1985 Senate Bill 136, 1985, Wisconsin Act 236, has various notes that explain what the differences are. And one is especially long that deals with the definition section. And it says 1A, that's improper means, so we won't deal with that. But it refers to the restatement of torts, 757, 758. Continuous use. The definition of trade secret contains a reasonable departure from the restatement of torts definition. Broader definition, the proposed act extends protection to a plaintiff who has not yet had an opportunity or acquired the means to put a secret, trade secret to use, etc. So I suggest you might want to look at that. It also drops three sections of the Uniform Act, but they don't seem to be of substantive value. 9 is not included because the Legislative Reference Bureau discourages the use of short titles. 10 is a severability clause, which we don't need because we have one. And Section 12 is not included because it hasn't repealed any existing statutory provisions. But the issue is whether or not we change the definition of trade secret, which would matter because you're relying on other case law. Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Furman, representing United Grease and United Liquid Waste Recycling.
May it please the Court, my name is Mark Furman, and I am counsel for United Liquid Waste Recycling, Inc. and United Grease, Inc., formerly known as United Grease, LLC, two other respondents in this case. Before I get started, I just want to remind the Court that I will not be addressing the 943.70 computer crime issue, as that claim was not made against our clients. Petitioner Burbank has made a claim against the United Entities that it has assisted or aided and abetted Mr. Sokolowski in the breach of a post-employment fiduciary duty of loyalty for the misappropriation of what they claim to be confidential information that does not rise to the level of a trade secret. As you know, we have argued that that claim is preempted under Section Sub 6A of the Act. Burbank's position is that its claim is saved under the Savings Clause found under 6B2, which provides that the Act prevents civil remedies that seek civil remedies for the misappropriation of trade secrets, but does not preempt civil remedies that are not based upon the misappropriation of a trade secret.
Mr. Furman, just so that I'm clear in my own mind, when the Circuit Court granted summary judgment in regard to the issues that you're addressing, it's my understanding that it did it only on the idea of preemption. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that if we were to find that that ruling was wrong, the Court didn't make any determination concerning genuine issues of material fact. Is that right? In other words, if we decide that preemption was wrongly applied in regard to the claims against your client, the matter would go back.
That's correct. Although the Court did make a finding that there were no material issues of genuine fact with respect to the trade secret issue.
Right.
But you're correct that the preemption issue, the breach of the duty of loyalty issue was determined solely based on the preemption argument.
And the aiding and abetting issue.
That's correct.
All right. Thank you.
Right.
Counsel, I'd like you to address head-on the plain meaning argument, which you are doing right now, of your opposing counsel. As I understand it, he goes to what you refer to as the savings clause in sub 6B2, and that indicates in A you have preemption set forth, and then B says this section does not affect any of the following. Two is any civil remedy not based upon misappropriation of a trade secret. And he says, aha, I lost. This isn't a trade secret. I lost that issue. This is not a trade secret. So I'm not preempted because I have, looking at the words of sub 2, a civil remedy that is not based on a misappropriation of a trade secret. So good. I'm not preempted. I can go forward.
Yes, let me address that. My response to that is that interpretation of that particular savings clause in the statute would lead to unreasonable or absurd results for the main reason that it would violate the entire statutory scheme of the Act. There's construction case law out there, Wisconsin law, such as the Milwaukee County case cited in our brief, which indicates that you're supposed to construe the entire statute so that you give effect to its entire purpose and not frustrate the overall statutory scheme. Further, we also cite to the Boyle case. The Boyle case dealt with the preemption clause in a federal case, but the Wisconsin Court of Appeals in that case indicated that you should not interpret a savings clause so as to frustrate the overall scheme of the statute. And in this case, in the Boyle case, it was a statute that was intended to promote uniform standards for motor vehicle safety across the country. Chief Justice Abrahamson asked the question earlier, what's the point of the whole act? Let me make a few comments about that because I think it goes to your question about the plain meaning. The Learning Curve Toys case, which was an Illinois district case, which was cited in the Dill brief, indicated that the Illinois Trade Secret Act was intended to be a codification of all the various common law remedies for the theft of ideas. Similarly, in the Composite Marine case, which is a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals case, they said that the purpose of the Uniform Act was to abolish all common law theories of misappropriation of secret information and to provide a uniform definition. The result of the petitioner's plain language interpretation of the Savings Clause would be to completely frustrate that, because under their reading, we would have no more uniformity. Basically, an employer could go out and seek to protect information that does not rise to the level of a trade secret, when the whole point of the Trade Secret Act was to create a single definition of trade secret.
Yes, but counsel, when you're talking about claims of breach of loyalty or aiding and abetting, which would seem to be something that is a little apart from the trade secret. Now, you're saying that all is together, and that I just find that difficult to accept, unless you can tell me to cut off all other claims, and that's what basically is done here. Seems to be kind of a really broad interpretation, and I think both Justice Prosser and Chief Justice asked about whether our statute was as uniform, so to speak, as other states, and I think it was pointed out that it wasn't or isn't, and maybe that hasn't been properly explored yet, but just tell me why under B, I'll just look it up, under the 13490B2, it says this section does not affect any civil remedy not based upon misappropriation. So aiding and abetting, loyalty, how does that fall under there?
Well, first of all, the issue brought up by you and Justice Prosser is an excellent one, the issue being the Act really isn't uniform because there are subtle differences between the states. And I have to confess, as Attorney Eisenberg, that I have not compared the Uniform Act to all the other states. I have not done that. However, I
didn't mean to interrupt, but I think the point is that the Court of Appeals and others use cases from other states because, as you know, we just have Van Zeelen, maybe some others, but just Van Zeelen is the seminal case in this state. So the assumption was that this is a uniform act, and it's been pointed out perhaps it is not so uniform.
Well, when the legislature adopted the act, the Section 7, the Uniformity Clause that you speak of, it tells the court to apply and construe the Act in such a way that its construction and application will be uniform with other states that have not just adopted the Act but have adopted substantially identical provisions. So I think the legislator contemplated that there would be subtle differences between the Act. All I can tell you is that based on my review of the case law around the country, it all seems to be nearly identical to Wisconsin's as far as I can tell, at least with respect to the definition of a trade secret and their preemption clause and the savings clause.
Could I ask you, Mr. Fuhrman, in your opinion, did Mr. Sokolowski transfer any confidential information to your client?
It depends how you define confidential information, Your Honor.
Well, you get to define it.
I'm sorry?
My question, you get to define it.
Under the law, my answer to that would be no. No confidential information was transferred or taken by Mr. Sokolowski. He was allowed, he was given authorization, that's undisputed, to take certain information home, which was a whole hodgepodge of information based on take-home projects that he had. But under the law, that would not be confidential because it does not rise to the level of a trade secret. And I think that's the whole point of the Act, is to create a single definition. And there's, if I can add, there's additional law that's not Wisconsin law, but there's additional law that suggests the same conclusion. For example, the composite marine case that I've been referring to, the composite marine case indicated that absent, that if you've got an employer, an employee takes information that doesn't rise to a level of trade secret, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals stated that the employer is out of luck, has no remedy, unless there's a valid non-compete or confidentiality agreement. Now, although these are pre-WTSA cases in Wisconsin, the Van Zeeland case and the Kroon and Black case both say the same thing. They say, look, if you've taken no, if the former employee has taken with him or her no trade secret in the absence of a valid non-compete or confidentiality agreement, they've done no wrong. And I believe that the court tried to recognize that there may be circumstances where, you know, that may not seem fair. However, what they were trying to do is balance the need for promoting mobility of labor in the marketplace with the need of protecting commercial information. And the conclusion was that if you want to protect commercial information, it's got to rise up to the level of a trade secret, unless there's a valid contract.
Maybe I'm not correcting this, but maybe I got the wrong site, but that composite was a 92 case, so that was not pre, that was post.
Right, the composite was, I was referring to the Wisconsin cases were pre. Was the composite marine case was analyzing the Illinois uniform.
Yeah, and there they said that unless they misappropriated a statute of trade secret, there was no wrong.
Right, yeah. My only point was that was a post-Uniform Trade Secret Act in Illinois, and there, it's consistent with pre-Wisconsin Uniform Trade Secret law.
If I could follow up on that question, I understood you to say that none of the information, none of the information that Mr. Sokolowski acquired and transferred to your client was confidential. I assume then that you would agree with Mr. Eisenberg that it was okay, quote, to take that information.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Right. Then how could Burbank have had a confidentiality agreement on what isn't confidential?
Confidentiality agreements, non-disclosure agreements, non-compete agreements are permitted under Wisconsin law, and I've drafted many of them. And what it allows you to do is it allows you to define what your confidential information is. And the whole reason that we do these things is to create essentially a body of information that may not rise to the level of trade secret that we want to make sure is protected. But that confidentiality agreement, and I don't know if somebody might have said that the non-compete rules don't apply to confidentiality agreements, but they do under this court's decision in Tatke. The agreement has to meet the requirements of Section 103.465, which is this state's statute that regulates restrictive employment covenants. And under that statute, what it says is that it says, look, if you're an employer and you want to restrict your employee's ability to engage in post-employment competition, your covenant, your agreement has to meet a number of rigorous tests, which are carefully scrutinized by the court. And those tests include, for example, you have to show that it's reasonably necessary for the protection of the employer, it's reasonable to the employee, it's for a reasonable duration of time, you have to show that it's for a reasonable territory, you have to show that it's not in violation of public policy. So what do we have here? Mr. Sokolowski has no non-compete, he has no non-disclosure agreement, he has this code of conduct, which clearly doesn't meet the requirements of 103.465. So that's just another reason that I was going to get to as to why this interpretation, the petitioner's interpretation of the preemption clause doesn't make any sense. If we were to allow such, if we were to allow for the protection of this type of information, not only would it be in violation of the public policy provisions in the Van Zeelen case and the Kroon and Black case, but it would be, in my mind, it would be in violation of the legislature's provisions in 103.465.
Counselor, but aren't all those things in 103.465 questions of fact that have to be decided upon by a fact finder?
Yes.
Thank you.
Chief, if I might.
Justice Butler.
Mr. Thurman, let me point out what I think is bothering me, at least with respect to the arguments in this case, which, quite honestly, appear to be going past each other, the various sides, and perhaps Mr. Sissons would address this as well when he comes back. But as I understand your briefs and the briefs that are argued here, you're arguing preemption, and you're hanging your head on the statute and the statute only. Mr. Sissons is sitting here saying, wait a minute, I'm entitled to common law remedies. But when I hear you discuss the common law in Wisconsin, there is no common law remedy that's been recognized in Wisconsin. So why are you so concerned about just limiting your argument to the statute? What's wrong with saying, okay, under sub 6, you still lose? There is no common law remedy. I mean, that's the one thing that's been bothering me. That's why I keep coming back to this question of remedies,
right,
about the whole case.
Right.
What remedies are we talking about?
Right. That's actually in my laundry list here, and I think it was mentioned in my brief and Mr. Eisenberg's brief. The alternative argument here is that there is nothing to preempt. Section 396 of the restatement was cited in the Hartford elevator case, but it did not apply that section. There is no case in Wisconsin law that applies that section. And that section appears to create a post-employment duty on behalf of an employee not to use not just trade secrets, but it uses the word confidential information. That appears to me to be completely inconsistent with existing Wisconsin law. So the answer to your question is, as an alternative argument, yes, I believe that there is no duty for the post-employment breach of a duty of loyalty based on non-trade secret information in Wisconsin.
You define trade secret under the statute, under the uniform statute, to mean, it's a very broad definition, it says information. It's all confidential information.
That's my opinion.
And then if it doesn't fall within the statute as being confidential information, it doesn't fall under 396.
I would agree with that.
Sure. And if the company wants to protect non-trade secrets, that is non-confidential information, they have to do it by contract, defining what they mean by confidential information, which could be less than the trade secret statute, assuming it fits the other requirements of the Wisconsin state statute.
That's
your position.
That's my position.
As I understand it.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you agree that the various state interpretations have of the Trade Secret Act, some agree with you that it covers all confidential information, and if it's not confidential, nothing, unless there's some other statute. Others don't go that far. And that there's really a dispute among the jurisdictions on this issue.
When you say that they don't go that far.
Don't go so far as to say all confidential information is covered under the Trade Secrets Act.
I'm not quite sure I understand you. Are you referring to those cases that refer to where they say that if a claim is based on the same allegations as a trade secret, as a trade secret claim, then those would be preempted versus the cases that say, such as I think the Wisconsin Court of Appeals case that says if it's a trade secret, it's preempted, or if it's confidential information, that would be, I think, the broader version.
Right.
Right. You're right. There is a subtle distinction there. My response to that is that I suppose you may be able to come up with some types of confidential information that don't meet the requirements of a trade secret under the definition. But if you look at that definition, and I was kind of struggling with that similar issue, I was trying to think of what is the definition of confidentiality, confidential information. The Seventh Circuit has said that it doesn't matter if you call it confidential, trade secret, or proprietary information. It's all the same thing. I don't know the answer to that, but if you look at the requirements for a trade secret, it seems to me that it would embody anything that would reasonably be considered confidential, commercially confidential, which is important. In other words, it has to have independent economic value. It has to be not readily ascertainable. I'm forgetting the third one. Generally not known to others. Could you have confidential information if it is readily known to others? Could you have commercially confidential information if it has no independent economic value that arises out of its arises out of the fact that it's being kept a secret? I don't know that you could. It seems to me that if you don't meet those basic requirements in the Trade Secret Act, your information just doesn't even seem to, just from a common sense standpoint, strike me as being confidential at all. So, and I think that there was the whole point of the Act, saying it was to try to answer the question, what does it mean to be confidential? And they happened to call that a trade secret. They could have called it anything.
They could have called it confidential information.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Sissons?
Thank you. The discussion about case law that preceded the trade secret statute, namely the Van Zeelen case, I want to address that briefly. I think the fact that the statute came after that case is very significant and actually supportive of Burbank Grease's position. As I understand the position of counsel, the legislature knew the broad way that the court decided the issue in Van Zeelen, in other words, saying that the only thing that's protectable is something that rises to the level of a trade secret, and therefore assumed it within the statute. And I don't believe that that makes any sense. If the legislature was in fact applying that same sort of a broad rule, it simply would have changed the definition of trade secret to include all this information and any other confidential business information. It would have been a very easy solution. But that's not the way that they decided it. The definition of trade secret is a very defined term, and it would do quite a bit of harm to the body of case law that this Court has issued in the past to take a very specific, defined term in a statute such as this and inject new language that dramatically expands the scope. I do believe that the legislative history of the Trade Secrets Act supports Burbank Grease's position. Again, if you look at all the quotes that all the parties put in their briefs, the preemption is designed to only affect those trade secret claims. And the Commission did state the Act does not apply to a duty imposed by law that is not dependent on the existence of competitively secret information, like an agent's duty of loyalty to his or her principal.
That's
true. The duties are excluded, and the duty under the trade secret statute arises by virtue of the fact that something is a trade secret. This, by contrast, is a duty that applies because the person is an agent that has to keep the interests of their principal at heart.
That comment does not use the word trade secret. That comment uses the word competitively significant secret information, which means that's how they're interpreting the USTA. And there's another comment that says, like traditional trade secret law, the Uniform Act contains, this is a Wisconsin comment, contains general concepts. The contribution of the Uniform Act is substitution of unitary definitions of trade secret and trade secret misappropriation and a single statute of limitations for the various property, quasi-contractual, and violation of fiduciary relationship theories of non-contractual liability utilized at common law.
The beginning of that quote, though, I do believe, I don't have it in front of me, I think does start out with a reference to trade secret information.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's why it's significant. I think it may come back to this issue that we were discussing a little bit earlier about the value of this information, the underlying value of information. I think I've heard it argued that if something isn't a trade secret as specifically defined in this statute, it has no value. And that simply can't be the case. This court would never enforce a confidentiality agreement requiring an employee to protect something that has no value. There would be no protectable interest in doing so. It would never be enforced. And so that's why I believe that the appropriate way to read the statute is to accept out contract remedies and other civil remedies, in other words, other things that don't deal with trade secrets. I think the policy that this court has enunciated in many, many cases is that it favors the mobility of workers, the chance to go from one job to another. It looks very strictly and closely at any attempts to prevent an employee from doing so. But I'm quite confident that this court has never said that it's the policy of the state of Wisconsin to allow employees to use something that doesn't belong to them. And again, getting back to the implications of what the Court of Appeals decision means, you could plan on taking information and take literally boxes and boxes of information with total impunity. That cannot be the policy of this court. And when counsel has indicated before that in drafting agreements over the years, parties can be very specific about what they want in a confidentiality agreement. In fact, you never can be specific enough. But what I'm certain of is that a jury should have an opportunity to listen to evidence such as this and find out if the kind of information that was taken and the duties that the employee had mean that there should be some action. If someone, after he stops working at a company, goes to work for IBM, and finds something in his briefcase, you bet he should make a beeline back to his former employer and return it. We don't want to create a policy where it says, no, you can't have it back. I'm going to use it for myself. And that is what the Court of Appeals decision would do. Thank you.
I want to thank, on behalf of the Court, Mr. Sissons, Mr. Eisenberg, and Mr. Furman, for their excellent arguments today in attempting to enlighten the Court on the Uniform Act. We therefore close this hearing, 04-AP-468, Burbank Lease Services versus Sokolowski. And the Court will take a recess of a few moments so that these students may leave and other students may enter the courtroom. We're in recess.